Ampelography, Enology, Viticulture, Trockenbeer and Auslesen, Bienvenue, Batar Monroche, and Frontal Lobotomy are all words that we use in the wine world today. Of course, I'd never heard of any of these terms when I started in the wine class in 1970 in Haskell's in Minneapolis, Minnesota. But we were just up-and-coming wine geeks, a bunch of us young guys. We learned very quickly, though, that you could look up any of these wine terms in the Alexis Lachine Encyclopedia. He had already written it, and we didn't know it, but he was the master. But not only did he own Chateau Lascombes in Margaux, he had three very small vineyards in Burgundy. Highlight those in a bit. He was the owner and general manager of Alexis Lachine Imports in New York and in Bordeaux. He owned a three-bedroom flat overlooking Central Park, which a lot of people I found out have actually been to and were quite amazed by it. He had a vacation place in Barbados where he met and married his third wife, Arlene Dahl, and he had his beloved chateau, Puri Lachine, in Margaux. And he had just finished the first only Encyclopedia of Wine. So imagine back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, if you wanted to learn anything about French wine, there was no place to go. There was no Google. There was no encyclopedia. But Alexis Lachine did finally produce the first encyclopedia. So he really launched the wine world for us Americans. And it was made in an American style. So it is and is today, it was and is today, one of the finest dictionaries on wine. I might mention to you as a sidebar that it's still available on Amazon.com for a ridiculously small amount of money of like $5 or something. Came out at $20. His empire story was truly a rags-to-riches story, and I want to go through it briefly with you. And it took a very serious man to put the empire together. But I have to tell you quite honestly that all those words that I used in the beginning, frontal lobotomy is really not an industry word. But I just sort of threw it in there because it's one of my favorite jokes about the wine industry. And you got to throw in a little levity if you're a book author, because book reports and author reports can be awfully dry. But unlike the scientists and scholars of the time of the 50s, they also drank wine regularly, and they also adhered to the maxim that they'd rather have a wine bottle in front of me than a frontal lobotomy. than a frontal lobotomy. I did that right. The other terms I used are real words in the wine industry. Ampelography is the study of the origin of grapes. In fact, there was a great example of it at work just recently. There was a move in Sacramento to name the state grape Zinfandel. And fortunately, we knew that university professor of genetics Carol Meredith followed the DNA literally from Zinfandel here in California all the way back to the Dalmatian coast and found that it is indeed in that cradle of civilization called, ready for this? This is a tongue twister, Solenjanac Castellansky, Zinfandel. And although it was going to be named as a historic wine in California, we all went nuts in the wine industry and we said, stop, wait a minute, what are you doing? You're crazy. And fortunately, Arnold Schwarzenegger vetoed it, and we don't have that as the name. But we do know from ampelography that it was an original grape from the Dalmatian coast, and it probably the only grapes that were here in California from the cradle of civilization, if there was one here, were called and are called Vitis California and Vitis Americanus. We grow Vitis vinifera from France, and you all know that story about how the Vitis vinifera saved and then resaved our phylloxera problem. We've all heard that story. We know that whole ampelography science, but then that segues into viticulture, which is an important term, too, in the wine industry. And I just like to do some sidebars about wine because I get a lot of questions about the wine industry. You can't really just take a grape seed and plant it in the ground and get a grapevine. I don't know if you knew that or not, but in the world of viticulture, which is the PhD science of growing grapes, you take an original Vitis something, Vitis americanus, vinifera, and you whack it off down at the bottom, and you take the nodule from a Chardonnay grape or the knuckle of the actual cane, and you actually surgically attach it to that budwood, and that becomes a Chardonnay. And that's how we grew grapes in California from the 1800s and have been ever since. We also know that from viticulture that you can't just plant any grape anywhere you want to. You can't plant Chardonnay in Calistoga. It's way too hot. You're crazy if you do. And so we know from viticulture that you want to plant Chardonnay, just as an example of the many hundreds of grape-growing grapes, that you want to plant it in a cool area like the Canaris District at the southern end of Napa and Sonoma. Or in New Zealand, Chardonnay does very well there. Or in the cool Côte d'Or in Burgundy, France. And it was in Burgundy, France that Alexis Lachine first started his career of tasting wine out of barrel. I'm going to kind of bounce around his career because his life was absolutely fascinating. But he was an employee of Frank Schoonmaker in 1937 in New York. And Frank Schoonmaker had a fine wine shop, and Alexis was asked to go to Burgundy and taste wine with the famous publisher of Revue de Vin de France, Raymond Baudouin. He was, at the time, the most influential person in the wine industry in the whole world because he produced and edited the Revue de Vin de France, and he was just more than happy to take this young guy out of New York who had worked in the wine industry a little bit in his teens in Paris and take him to all the wine tasting areas in Burgundy. I want to refer to the book. On one of the Alexis and Baudouin's many travels, they stopped at a restaurant for lunch. It was a very plain wine menu. The only thing that set this particular wine menu from others is that it listed the now famous 1929 Romani Conti. Anybody ever had a Romani Conti? Okay. It was priced at the paltry price of 75 francs a bottle, which is equivalent to about $7. And that vineyard was at the time and is now one of the top Pinot Noir vineyards on this planet. And you'll drive by it when you go on this trip to Burgundy. For some unknown reason, the restaurateur was unable to sell this fantastic wine. Lachine and Baudouin bought one bottle, tested it out, and bought the remaining 11 bottles for $100. At the instance that I started writing this book, I contacted Jim Smith, who had just had the 1929 Romani Conti, and he said, quote, "It's still a fabulous bottle. It was very powerful, vibrant, has a very dark ruby color. And today's value is somewhere near $3,000 a bottle." So imagine if you'd have bought it then. That's what it's worth today. I jumped a little bit ahead because it's really difficult to cover Lachine's life, as I said, all of his 76 years. But he was born in Moscow in 1913. And at 5 years old, he and his sister and his mother and his banker father left during the 1918 Russian Revolution, and traveled east in Russia to land here in San Francisco for about a year, and then New York for about a year, following the Russian immigrants, and then finally Paris. And it was in Paris that they had a tourist agency where Alexis would be the young man with the solid little megaphone, and he'd be saying, "And now the Champs-Élysées," and he spoke French fluently, so he could say "La Elysium de Margaux" or anything. And so he was very popular, but these were tough times, and it taught Alexis Lachine the value of a dollar, as we'll see later on in his life. However, World War II came along, and he was commissioned a first lieutenant in the Army Intelligence in the Delta Bar section. And with his food and wine experience and his reputation for running a fine mess, he soon caught the ear of General Eisenhower. I'm going to quote to you something that was told to me by his son. But the reason that he was basically a spy is that his son told me he could speak English, French, and Russian to an exactness, an absolute exactness. And so he was one of the men that for 5 years during World War II went behind the lines. I wasn't able to find out too many things about him, I want to tell you about his life with Ike Eisenhower. Major Lachine did everything. He acted as secretary, answered the phone calls, arranged for travel, and coordinated all meals and wine personally for Ike. As his aide-de-corps, Alexis was also invited to dine with Ike on numerous occasions. One of these many occasions was he was a host to the likes of General Patton as well as Winston Churchill. This is told to me by Arlene Dahl and Sasha Lachine, his son. It was the first meeting with Churchill that Alexis proved his master. It seemed that Winston Churchill thought himself quite a self-proclaimed expert in the wine area. He drank champagne every day for lunch. And after listening to Churchill's pontifications, Alexis could not control himself anymore. He interrupted Churchill and dialed right into a perfect dissertation on Bordeaux wines. He dazzled the Englishman, and Churchill sank into his armchair and proclaimed, "Young man, from now on, you'll do the talking and I'll do the listening." The great Winston Churchill. Another of the things that we were so fascinated about, and I say we because I had a lot of people help me with the book. Some of them are in New York. Some are one is right here in the room. Helped me edit it, Deb Ferris. One of the things that I just kept finding more and more things about this guy that just blew me away, and I'll tell you how I met him and the fact that he is really my mentor in a moment. But one of the things that he did was estate bottling. And has anybody heard of George Dubuff? Raise your hand. Okay. You know that he is Mr. Beaujolais. But before he met Dubuff, he got out of the army. He was awarded the Order of Leopold, the Belgian Bronze Star, the recognition from the French Legion of Honor. So he had to have been doing something during World War II. We don't know what. The 5 years he was there, all he would say to his son is that it was the finest time of his life and that he absolutely admired Eisenhower as a general. After World War II, he moves to New York and he settles down and he marries the Contessa Renee de Villeneuve. And his first big break in the wine industry, which we all get eventually, was that he was named the export director of Chateau Aubryon. This meant he had absolute financial success. Up until that point, he was working as a wine salesman in New York. But to be appointed the export director for Chateau Aubryon meant and means, even to this day, as Chateau Aubryon is one of the five top Bordeaux's in Bordeaux, France, sells for a beginning price of $200 a bottle, goes as high as $40,000 a bottle for older vintages. It meant that you were the ambassador for that chateau, and you had a job forever. And you basically went to the great hotels and wine shops in America and sold Chateau Aubryon. It led then to his forming his own company, and in 1955, with the help of three Minnesota partners, don't ask me why the partners were from Minneapolis, but they were, Alexis officially founded the Alexis Lachine Import Company in New York. He started the company with $28,000, and he originated it in the small town of Margaux. In my book, you'll see pictures of it. Where his bottling line was. His son was absolutely wonderful in getting me pictures that you'll see in the book. He then did another most amazing thing, but I want to quote about George Dubuff. And what they did was they found a blood transfusion truck in Burgundy, literally, and they turned it into a portable bottling line. Nobody ever thought of that, but why not? A blood transfusion truck is sterile. It's portable, and it's got piping and tubes. And so along with George Dubuff, I'm going to read what George wrote back to me. Yes, we trucked a lot of, quote, rail route containers between 1957 and 1980. We had five sellers for aggregation in Burgundy. Our third partner was Maurice Nino, who lived in Beaune. I was the first embotellier, I'm going to bastardize that French name, bottler, basically, a façon, registered in France. That was the beginning to Lexus as it was exactly what he was looking for, estate bottling. Never had the wineries had the chance to put their own name in the bottle. They just were big, large producers like Louis Jadot and et cetera, et cetera. And Alexis allowed them to be able to put their name on the bottle with a simple little blood transfusion truck with the help of Georges Deboeuf. And by the way, Georges Deboeuf and a lot of people from France were just absolutely wonderful in helping me write this book. And I really had more than I needed of information. Then he released his book, and he began his negociant business in Margaux. And here's the next most amazing thing he did. He got a small billboard company to actually take a picture of Chateau Puy-Lachine and put it on a billboard in Bordeaux, leading right up the main freeway, highway back then. And in Bordeaux, they were going to throw him in jail because you just didn't do that. You didn't advertise on billboards. You advertised in the proper place, which was magazines or the New York Herald in London. So not only did he start advertising on billboards, but he just had this one little line down at the bottom of the billboard that said, degustation, wine tasting. Now, up until that time, this was 1951, when he owned Puy-Lachine, you couldn't go to a chateau and taste wine. You had to know somebody. And he just said, that's ridiculous. So he opened up a portion of the winery to customers. And, again, they were ready to throw him in jail, but they noticed he was making a lot of trips to the bank. And a lot of people were buying wine and remembering that they'd bought it at the tasting room at Chateau Puy-Lachine. So we wouldn't have tasting rooms today if it had not been for Alexis Lachine, or they would have been somewhere later. By now he's on top of the world. This is the 50s. And how I met him was really quite fascinating. I'm originally from Minneapolis, and I landed a job at the best store, the best wine shop in Minneapolis called Haskell's. And the Haskell story is a whole another wonderful story I cover briefly in the book. But Benny and Fritzi Haskell were German Jews who escaped the Nazis, came to Minnesota in the 30s, and were bootleggers. You know, why not? Somebody had to sell the booze. And she was this charming little strawberry redhead. He was a boxer. So they made a great pair. And they were the two top bootleggers during Prohibition in Minneapolis. And so when Prohibition ended, Benny could not have the license because he had to go to jail. But she kept the license because she didn't go to jail. So the license started in her name, and Haskell's Wines and Spirits started in Minneapolis, Minnesota, right after Prohibition, the day it ended, and she became a wine expert. She knew that wine was going to happen. And so she was on radio. She was doing her own menus and wine pairings, and she just built an empire while Benny sold liquor, and they basically became the number one wine and liquor store in the Midwest, literally the Midwest. And I had the luck of joining them on the floor as a young kid at 23 years old in 1970 and started working for Fritzi Haskell. And I was just a kid. I mean, I'd probably had 3 years in the wine business, but I really wasn't a professional. I didn't know all those terms. I didn't really even know what a malolactic fermentation was, or viticulture, or anything. And Fritzi Haskell had was a very large store, and she had a podium about three feet high, kind of in the middle of the store, and she had a desk and her chair there, and then two desks in front of that chair and this desk. And so she looked out across this big liquor store, and her back was just nothing but all fine wines from Bordeaux, Burgundy, Germany, Alsace, Port, Madeira, you name it. And she held court. That was her deal. She ran the store because she was a little pipsqueak, but up on that podium, she was a pretty powerful person. So you really, you only got to sit in those two chairs if you were doing something wrong, or you were a salesman, or you were a very important person who'd come in to buy wine, or you were just, you know, the lead singer from the opera in Minneapolis. So on one particular day, I walk past that desk. I'm coming into the store from a break, and here's this really dapper-looking guy in a beautiful Italian dark suit with a pink shirt, cufflinks, and Italian black shoes. Now, this is 1970. Men and pink shirts just didn't happen. It was very strange to me. And I was wearing my uniform, which was at the time, you had to wear a uniform if you worked in a wine shop, of a black slacks, blue sport coat, white shirt, black tie. That was it. There was nothing else. You had to wear the uniform. So I noticed Alexis Lachine. I then found out it was Alexis Lachine sitting there talking to Fritzy. And I went over to my buddy who worked there, Harvey Brahms. And I said, "Who is that? Who is that guy?" And he said, "Well, come here." And we walked over to the Bordeaux wall. And here's 50 chateaus, all imported by Alexis Lachine. I said, "That's him?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "I got to meet him. I have to meet him. I want to be a wine connoisseur, and I really want to meet a real wine connoisseur." And he said, "Well, you know, you should wait about a year, maybe 2 years, and see if you can get Fritzy Haskell to introduce you." So I turn around, and he's gone. So I go on break, and it's evening time, and I go to what was then the Radisson Hotel's lobby. I put a dime in the phone, and I called the Radisson Hotel, and I asked if Alexis Lachine was at the hotel. He answered the phone, and he said, "I'd love to meet you for a glass of wine." And that's how I met him. He came down. We sat at the restaurant. We had a beautiful light dinner. We had a bottle of white Burgundy, and he just literally mapped out my whole career. Just went crazy, because that was Alexis Lachine. He would do almost anything for anybody who wanted to be seriously in the wine business. And a lot of people didn't know that, but it was really true. And, of course, I went home with my two napkins, and I hear all these scribbling things on the napkins, where I'm supposed to go, when I'm going to go, and et cetera, et cetera. So in 1971, I left Haskell's, and I went to France. And I studied and worked at the chateaus that he recommended, including his, the Puri Lachine, for a day or two. I went from Mouton to – I had a great time for 2 days at Mouton, meeting Blondin, who smoked three packs of Gitans a day. Here's a guy who's making the fifth most expensive wine in Bordeaux, and he's got this Gitan out of his mouth, and he's never without his Gitan cigarette in front of his face, and he makes these great wines. So actually, we stayed there 3 days, and then we went to Pontet-Canet and everybody else that Lachine had said, "Here's where you're going to go to," and they just opened up the doors. And they gave us lunches and, of course, wine and free access to the cellars. And my buddy Jeff Brown and I did that for 5 months. And I came back and I decided I'm going to become an Alexis Lachine. So after that day that he was at Haskell's, I didn't know it, but he had just sold the Alexis Lachine company. And it's a very long, convoluted story about how he owned Chateau Lascombes with the Rockefeller and 15 other important people at the time, and sold that to Bass Charrington. And then he had his import company, which he was doing at the time, the equivalent would be today of about $60 million a year importing wine from Bordeaux to the United States and Canada and a couple other countries. But the Alexis Lachine name on a bottle of wine was like the good seal of house approval, housekeeping. It was your signification that you would always get a great bottle of Beaujolais or a great bottle of Pouilly-Fouisset and it was a great price. That was his secret, one of his other secrets. And, of course, he had a palate. He knew really good wine. Well, all this time, he's not having a very good time with his relationships with women. But the one woman who really helped me write the book, became his third wife, was Arlene Dahl. And you can read the book, if you'd like, about the other two wives that didn't quite make it. And, of course, Arlene helped me immensely with this book, and she chose the name The Pope of Wine. Had not been, who knows Arlene Dahl, the actress? Heard of her, seen her movies? We just rented one of her movies. It's an old 50s thing. She's real cutie, blondie, you know, just a femme fatale. It's just great actress. Pardon? Strawberry hair. Right. So, let me quote from the book again. Although the books were doing well, Alexis's marriage to Giselle, second wife, did not fare well. After 6 years of marriage, they were divorced. It was the longest serious relationship Alexis had ever had with a woman. Giselle then married a guy from Reader's Digest, and Alexis's third wife, Arlene Dahl, noted, quote, Giselle left Alexis for Robert. Alexis fell apart for 6 months and went into a tailspin, unquote. Waiting at the end of the spin was his next wife and Sasha's new stepmother, Arlene Dahl. Alexis had met the movie star Arlene Dahl in 1964 in Los Angeles, and because he traveled so much, it was only natural that he would sell his wines in Los Angeles. And so there was a wine tasting put together, and knowing that the great wine connoisseur Alexis Lachine was to be the guest, this is Arlene telling me the story 2 years ago, Arlene had earlier learned from a local wine merchant that the two best wines Alexis had sold in Los Angeles were the two latest vintages of 1959 Lascombes and 1957 Chateau Pierre Lachine. She was not only a great actress, she was very smart, as I learned writing the book with her. She'd already read up on all the wine and was quite familiar with the basics. And the hostess, Jarma, was not only a great... She seated Alexis next to Arlene. She turned her papers in. It was one of those evenings where you get the wines in front of you and you guess what they are, and then you turn them into the hostess. And of course, she got them correct. And he called the next day, and they went on their first date at the Ambassador Hotel and Restaurant. And even though she was taken with Alexis, she had a moral clause with MGM, the studio, in that she was not allowed to have any improprieties unless she was married. It was in her contract. And I did the same thing you did. I said, what? She said, yeah. Back in those days, if MGM had you under contract, you had to do 5 movies, and they paid you, and you couldn't have any kind of anything going on sexually until you were married. Quote, Alexis was the greatest salesman. He could sell ice to Eskimos. Finally, he talked me into a trip to Barbados under the guise of a vacation. We got married there instead. Arlene Dahl. That marriage didn't last very long either. Alexis didn't seem to be the kind of guy that maybe the women couldn't tolerate him. I'm not sure, because there were a lot of people, when I would not only just say, tell me your experiences with Alexis Lachine, but I'd say, what was he really like? You know, did he go to movies? Did he swear? Did he get drunk? You know, I asked real personal questions. And in reality, he was just absolutely bent on being the number one wine connoisseur on this planet. And so he never did anything other than wine. He played a little game of cards that he sort of designed himself just to keep his son from getting nuts. But on Sundays, he'd do wine. He might see a movie, but he'd be doing speeches, or he'd be doing investigations on other wine shops, whatever town he was in. Arlene again says, quote, he was a very complicated man. His friends never got gifts from him, nor did he ever give them away. But in the strangest gesture, I was notified at the first Halloween after my divorce that 3 truckloads of barrels of wine were headed to my house. It had been Alexis's custom to give each one of his children a barrel of wine with their name on it, Alexandra and Sasha, and then her 2 children, his stepchildren. It was given to each of them on the year of their birthday. The only catch was that they were stored at the Puri. He never gave you the barrel. He kept them at the chateau. But your name was on it, a barrel. That's 55 gallons of wine. Now they were sitting in Arlene's front yard in Los Angeles for all to see. It was a very strange occurrence indeed, but that was Alexis, never a conformer. Arlene Dahl. She incidentally married Lamas, and I'm forgetting Lamas' son's first name, has been in contact with me, and he's now reading the book. He's thinking about maybe doing a movie because he thought it was a really good idea. So we might see this someday like that. Alexis died in 1989, and he left Chateau Puri-Lachine to his son. His son sold it, Sasha, in 1999 for $28.8 million. After dispersing the funds to his sister in New York, still living there, and his mother, still living there in the same building in New York City, he purchased Chateau Declan in Provence. David, you asked about that earlier. He's now in the Provence. He makes mostly rosé. He, again, like his father, totally off the hook, makes a $100 bottle of rosé. Only a few of them, a few barrels, but his new wine is called Whispering Angel. Thank you. Yeah, it just came out. It's in the second release. Do you like it? Yeah. $15, great rosé. So, again, like his father, way ahead of his time, making nothing but rosé, mostly rosé. And he's carrying on the Lachine name and using one of my favorite quotes that Alexis Lachine said, quote, "Buy a corkscrew and use it." And I want to thank you very much. And I just want to leave that last note about the Commonwealth Club doing the Burgundy tasting. Christine is in the back. Raise your hand again. Christine, okay. I've actually been to the Hospice de Beaune many times, which will be one of your main stops. The Hospice de Beaune is a hospital. It was the first hospital in the Dark Ages. And you'll see all the old beds that just had a curtain behind between each one of the beds. You'll see the old instruments that they used back then, pretty archaic. But to this day, all the people in Burgundy own the Hospice de Beaune, or the hospital, and they have the national, international wine auction there every year this fall. And they literally do a wine auction of barrels of all the wine from the districts in Burgundy. So you'll be able to buy a barrel of Pellini Monarchet by Albert Gracian, or you'll be able to buy a barrel of Pommard. And those prices that are set each year at the Hospice de Beaune set the prices for the whole world of wine for Burgundy. So it's a very famous place, and it's a great spot, great, nice thing to see. And the food is fabulous in Burgundy, as you might well imagine. And the Pinot Noirs are in the north, and the Chardonnays are in the south. And if you get a chance, go to I hope you go to Pellini Monarchet or Chassagne Monarchet, little teeny villages the size of South Beach, just teeny, teeny, maybe 10 buildings in these little villages. And there you'll taste the finest Chardonnays on the planet, I think. Pliny Monarchet, Chazani Monarchet, etc. So get on that trip if you can. And thanks very much. I wanted to throw the rest of the evening into Q&A, and I do it in two different ways. One is you can ask me anything, of course, about the book and writing of the book, which was a three-year project. But I also will answer any question that you have had about wine that you've been dying to ask a wine connoisseur. And the most ridiculous question I've already done is, how many grapes does it take to put in a bottle of wine? So I've already done that one. Don't ask me that one, because that was silly. In front. Well, that's a real loaded question. I'll tell you why. Because remember I talked about viticulture, the study of grapes? Okay. In the study of grapes, Pinot Noir is the most complicated grape there is on this planet. And to give an example, in Cabernet Sauvignon, we know there are only 8 clones of Cabernet Sauvignon. Like apples, there's Pippin, there's Granny Smith, there's blah, blah, blah. There's maybe 100 different kinds of apples. But in Pinot Noir, there are 200 clones of Pinot Noir. So if you really, really get into Pinot Noirs, you have to have your blinders totally off and accept the fact that you're going to get from A to Z. You're going to get Pinot Noirs from California that are that taste like tea and are light and rosé and are astringent as possible. You're going to get Pinot Noir. I just made a Pinot Noir. It'll be out June 9th. We're bottling it. And I got grapes from Jason Palmeyer, and I wanted a Pinot Noir that had huge amount of chocolate and cherries and thick and dark and rich. They don't make those like that in Burgundy anymore. The Burgundians make the original 200 clones, and even they don't know what they have. So if you taste a Gevrey Chambertin from any producer, and then you step over 6 rows to somebody else's Gevrey Chambertin, it's going to be a completely different Pinot Noir. It's a real quest. Nobody has identified all 200 yet. There are people that are trying. It'll take years and years and years to do the actual DNA on all 200 of them. And every time somebody gets close to the, hey, I found another one, somebody else finds another one. Like Richard Peterson found one in London, a Pinot Noir growing in the suburbs of London, an original Pinot Noir. He brought the rootstock to Napa and made a champagne out of it. So, tough question. Real tough question. Sir. Okay. Okay. Great question. He was Russian, but once they founded the tour bus company in Paris, they became French because they had a French business. And they did carry, at the time, he was a banker, so they carried jewelry and gold coins is how they made it. And they literally just secreted, you know, across border after border. And so they went from Moscow to Vladivostok. Did I pronounce that rightly? And then they waited, and they said, maybe the war's not going to last. And they waited 6 months. It got worse. So then they went to – they came here to San Francisco thinking maybe the war won't end because he owned a bank. He was a very wealthy guy, and he was a lawyer, his dad, a picture of him in the book. And the war still didn't end. So then they came to New York, and they followed the Russians to the Russian district of New York. War still didn't end. And he finally just said, Paris, that's it. That's got to be it. Because if we live in Paris and the war ends, we may be able to go back. Well, by the time they had about 3 or 4 tour buses, their money started running out. They just weren't making it financially. So Lachine went to work for the Times Herald in London as an ad salesman, pure and simple. And the reason he liked wine and started to go to wineries to get their ads is because during his time in Paris, he joined a card club, and he and 3 other guys would play cards. Then at the end of the card game, they'd buy a bottle of really inexpensive Cote de Leon for 2 francs or something like that. And he was raised in Paris like that, so he got to know the wines. But always throughout of his time as being a salesman for the New York Times Herald in London, he wanted to be an American. So in the 30s, he came to Boston and applied for citizenship and then was given citizenship and went to a university in Boston. Didn't last long. He didn't like college, or they didn't like him or whatever. So when when he worked for Schoonmaker, you had no choice. I mean, he wanted to be in the military. He wanted to get into the Army, and he really wanted to get into espionage. It was, you know, he loved it. It was a great thing. So when his number was called, he said, sign me up. So
he was in America.
Yes, he was. And he was an American. Yeah, he stayed the 5 years and became a citizen. And then World War II broke out, and then he was drafted into the intelligence of the U.S. Army. And they saw that he was so adroit at speaking that they sent him directly to the French front in North Africa. And his commission was a Major Ratté. If you look up World War II, one of our great generals in the north of France. And he was Ratté's aide-de-corps. And then when Ike found out that he was doing this amazing job of, you know, cooking and finding great wines, he said, get that guy in my camp. He's mine. So, other questions? There was another great story about when he was in North Africa and he was working for Ratté. There were no ships going out getting seafood of any kind, no fish, because we were at war. And the North African part of the, that was the, what is that, the Mediterranean, you couldn't take your Navy boats out unless, your fishing boats, unless they were escorted with Navy boats. So he organized with General Ratté some fishing boats that were guarded by Navy vessels, and they went out and got a catch of Dover sole, and everybody went nuts because they had fresh fish, and they kept doing that until Eisenhower found out, and then all the fish went up to Eisenhower's camp. So, any other questions? Please do. Sure. Exactly. Well, first of all, Burgundy is where winemaking started. It didn't start that at the same time in Bordeaux. The Romans made wine. They were perhaps one of the best viticulturists and enologists of the time, and they formed what was then the wine-making and grape-growing industry to supply themselves with their wines. And as you know, the Romans were great traders, and so they shipped barrels of their wine to Constantinople, what is now Sicily. And so the vineyards of Burgundy started before, right after the Dark Ages. No, I'm sorry, it would be before the Dark Ages. So by the time the Dark Ages ended, you had many, many, many thousands of farmers who had been supplying grapes to the Romans, and then they get married, and what do you get when you get married? A piece of land. And so even today, I was just at a Burgundy tasting. By the way, the 2009 Pinot Noirs, I'm going to predict and tell you right now, are going to be as great as the 1947s. I just had them with one of the producers out of Burgundy. We were at he did a wine tasting for us, and Olivier Laflèvre is the producer, and the 2009s are as great as the ones that I had back in the 70s, I was drinking 45s and 38s because they were $25 a bottle. I could afford it. But even then, when I talked to him, I asked him about some of my friends in Burgundy. And, for instance, in Mercury, Bertrand Deviard, who is the heir to Chateau de Chemerey, left his position as CEO at Chateau de Chemerey, and now his kids are dividing up Chateau de Chemerey, which is a vineyard in Mercury. And so there'll be three new owners of three pieces of Chateau de Chamerey in Mercury, as there has been for thousands of years. Versus in Bordeaux, Bordeaux was really started in the 1700s by wealthy barons from Paris. And that was their summer home. And what do you do in Bordeaux? Grow grapes. So Bordeaux started 1700s. David Arnault might know that. Bordeaux, Lafitte Latour, 1738, something like that. No, it was way before that. But Bordeaux was many, many, many years later. And, for instance, the Chateau Lascombes that Lachine owned and bought was actually passed down from the man who settled the Suez Canal in court in Paris and was... and purchased Chateau Lascombes with his money that he made from the lawsuit of settling the Suez Canal with France and whoever else was in it. That's how he bought Chateau Lascombes in the 1800s. So Bordeaux is much younger. Let me do the front here. Go ahead. Oh, and the question was Arlene Dahl's, the one that suggested the name of the book, The Pope of Wine, but I didn't explain why. Well, in 1959, he was on top of the world. He was it. As I mentioned, he had two chateaus, three vineyards in Burgundy, this palatial place in Bordeaux, in New York City, facing Central Park. He had this import company. He was the number one importer in America. He had written and published three books, and they literally ran an article on him in the New York Times and called him the Pope of Wine. So it was somebody in the New York Times that said, Alexis Lachine comes to town. 1959, he launched his book, and then he went on the speaking circuit with the book, and they called him the Pope of Wine. So, yeah, he was 76. Yeah. I'll touch on that in a second. David has a question.
How much do you think somebody would have to pay, say, between one bottle, you already
claimed? Oh, I can tell you exactly. The 2009 Romani Contis are coming out in next spring, and they'll be $1,000 a bottle. Because Von Romani, at the tasting I was at, was around $855 a bottle. Starting price, yeah, $1,000. Excuse me. No, that's first tranche. That's what you'd buy it for in Paris. By the time it gets here, it's another $1,500 to $1,000 added on. But Romani Conti, unless it's a really good vintage like the 69, now the 69 is worth around $10,000 a bottle. But the numbers right now in Bordeaux are just staggering because China has just discovered Bordeaux. And for some reason, the Chinese industrialists, we're not talking about entrepreneurs in Hong Kong, we're talking about the mainland China wealthy people, are now saying, I want a bottle of Chateau Lafite on my table, and I'm going to drink it. So what's the best? Well, right now it's 59 and 61. And so Lafite just went to Hong Kong, where Sasha now lives, and guess why Sasha lives there? Because he still controls vineyards in Bordeaux. And they did a tasting and an auction with Christie's. And the prices for those older vintages I mentioned doubled what they are in London last year. And then last Friday, Chateau Latour did the same thing. They're the top third Chateau in Bordeaux, and their 82 went for 44,000 pounds for a case. So multiply that times 1.64 and divide by 12. 1982, Latour. So it's the Chinese right now are just driving the wine business. Just amazing. And they will eventually go to Romani Conti, and they'll eventually want to buy Silver Oak and Dunn and the other great wines here in California. It's a matter of finding out that there's more than just Chateau Lafite. So. Okay. Right.
But I'm assuming you have a great selection of French wines.
Not so much French wines. My concept of wine, and has been since 1978 in the retail venue when I've had my first store and still have that original store in San Francisco, is that my wall of wine is about as big as that, and it should be wine from every part of the wine world. So that if you're having eggplant parmesan and you look it up and it says have a Suave, I want to have the best Suave for the money for you. Or if you're having Chinese food and somebody says, I hear the Tempranillo is great with Chinese food, I want two or three Tempranillo. So my concept in retailing has always been, what is the consummate wine seller, with a bent towards French wines. I still love French wines. And I do have some books if you want. They're $15 if you want one afterward. And the website is gourmetwines.com. And there's one question in the back.
Is that the name of the wine shop?
No, the wine shop's called Hennessy's. Right, like my last name. And the wine you had today is from my latest project, Leslie Hennessy Winery, where I'm making wine at Michael Mondavi's new place called Folio. So if you had that Sauvignon Blanc, it's that's the end of that Sauvignon Blanc, so it's ridiculously priced at $7. And the Merlot is $13, and the Pinot will be out next Thursday is $22. And the wine's at the shop, right. And there's business cards over there. So thank you.
Thank you, Leslie. He seems like the kind of guy you just want to sit and talk about wine with for a few hours, right?
Thank you so much.